This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Wildfire and the smoke from wildfire is a good reminder that climate change is not going to be solved by a single person, and that, like it or not, we're all going to have to work together to make it better.
You may have seen some headlines recently declaring that the Arctic is on fire. Are these just sensationalist reports, or do these fires represent an unprecedented and alarming danger? This week's guest on Sea Change Radio is Dr. Jessica McCarty, a satellite data expert and a professor at Miami of Ohio. She describes how weather data are collected, explains how this summer's Arctic fires in Greenland, Canada, Alaska, and Russia stack up historically, and tells us what they mean for the planet moving forward. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dr. Jessica McCarty. She's a professor in the Department of Geography at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. Jessica, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you're a satellite data analyst. What does that mean? It's in the Department of Geography, but it's not the kind of geography most listeners studied growing up, is it?
That's right. Everyone may have learned about state capitals and rivers and learned how to identify countries on maps. And that is an important part of geography. But what I do as a satellite data expert is kind of a combination of geography, environmental science, cultural studies, because you have to know something about the humans who are causing those changes, and engineering, because the satellite data is really a highly engineered data product. So you have to know something about how the satellite was designed, why it makes the data look and behave the way that it does. And then, of course, the spectral response, so the wavelengths of light in the electromagnetic spectrum and how each different band in a satellite image responds according to its placement in the EM spectrum. And that tells us something about the biophysical properties of the ground, so whether it's vegetation or bare soil or water or ice. And it also tells us something about the land use changes that humans are responsible for.
So Jessica, maybe you can put this summer's spate of Arctic fires in historical context for us.
Sure. So we do have some very good satellite-based and also ground reporting on large wildland fires in the Arctic parts of Central Siberia and Far Eastern Russia, using some of our satellite systems that go back into the mid-1990s. We do have reports of, you know, fire seasons and wildland fires emitting 4.4 metric tons of carbon per fire. And that is larger than the current carbon estimations that have been put into the media. So we know that Arctic fires have emitted more carbon than Sweden. I've seen that in some of our headlines. But we know that in the 1990s and early 2000s, similar large fires were happening in parts of Siberia and far eastern Russia. And we have data to show that. So that's some historical context for Siberia and Russia. For Greenland, we don't have the same kind of record. We have smaller fires being reported, but the first large wildfire in Greenland was reported just 2 years ago in 2017, and that was approximately 8.5 square miles, and it burned for an entire month. And then in Alaska, we have a long record, mainly kept by the state government, which has amazing analysts and wildland firefighters. And they have records of large fires in the boreal zone and even stretching into the tundra as early as the 1970s and 80s in the boreal forests and some large tundra fires in the early 2000s, which were discovered using some of the radar satellite systems, because these are in very remote areas. And so we do have historical records for these Arctic fires, but now we have the capability to monitor these fires on a near daily basis with satellite information, and are not relying on ground reports that may come in at the end of a fire season and not the time of the fires.
So give us some information on what's going on in places like Alaska, in Canada, Greenland, Siberia, etc.
Well, in general, the northern high latitudes, the Arctic area, if we think about that as 70 degrees north is above the tree line. And so any fire that occurs at essentially 70 degrees north, you will hear scientists refer as the Arctic. To be more precise, they'll often say high northern latitudes, because that includes 65 degrees north and above. In Greenland right now, the fires are occurring at approximately between 67 degrees north and 69 degrees north. And so they're not actually technically in the Arctic, even though Greenland is essentially one big ice sheet, right?
Right.
These are essentially peat fires, or we would call them high carbon-rich soils. We don't actually know that it's peat. It could be deep humus. Peat is a connotation of how much soil carbon there is down to a certain depth. And so you can have a lot of humus and it be pretty deep and it still not be peat. But these are fires that are burning across landscapes with no trees, very little woody or shrubby vegetation. So think about vicinium or blueberry type vegetation, sedges and grasses, mosses. This is very low vegetation. So it's literally burning up the soil carbon as it moves across Greenland's landscape. Mm-hmm. In order to do that, that means that the soil must be dry enough to burn. And that's something that scientists who are studying these Arctic fires, including myself, that's the thing that is most intriguing to us from a scientific point of view, but also is alarming in terms of climate change. Because Greenland has thousands and thousands of miles of coastline, right, and interior waterways as well, leading up to the Greenland ice sheet, and many, many thousands of lakes and streams. And so it's interesting and, of course, maybe discouraging that these soils are now hot enough and dry enough to sustain a wildfire. The fire that's going on now is very near the Arctic Circle Trail, which is a extremely famous and popular tourist site in Greenland. And the fire that is east of Sisimiut was actually started near one of the public camping houses of the Arctic Circle Trail. And there have been some issues with hikers getting lost in the smoke. It's that close to the trail. And so, you know, these fires may not initially be started by lightning. Very likely they're started by humans, just not, you know, putting campfires out. But the ecosystem itself has warmed enough that it can sustain a wildfire. And so we're now on week two, soon to be week three of this fire in Greenland. In 2017, a fire at almost 70 degrees north burned, that was almost 22 square kilometers, or about 8.5 square miles, burned for approximately 1 month. And it was not engaged in any way. It was allowed to burn freely. This fire in 2019 near the Arctic Circle Trail, they are actually deploying helicopter crews and field crews to try to put the fire out.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Dr. Jessica McCarty. She is a professor in the Department of Geography at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. Now, when we're talking about some of the tundra, we've heard about permafrost melting and that being a source of methane release around the planet. And it has people concerned as these areas that have been frozen for many, many years have begun to show signs of melting. Now, are some of these permafrost areas now catching fire? And if so, is that kind of unexpected? Are they kind of leapfrogging the natural, what scientists would expect would naturally occur in terms of it's gone from frozen tundra to melting permafrost and then maybe fires? Or is that a mischaracterization?
I think it's important to understand what the term permafrost means and then how it can sometimes be used in colloquially.
Okay, please. Yeah, expand.
Yeah. So permafrost is actually just a state in which soil can be. So it's the idea that the ground is frozen. And so permafrost means that it is, for all intents and purposes, perpetually frozen. So permafrost does not necessarily tell us much about the characterization of the soil itself. So some permafrost may have very low organic matter or carbon. And you can think about that as, you know how you burn peat logs on in your fireplace or in your backyard on a bonfire? Mm-hmm. That's high carbon. That peat is high carbon. Not all soils have that much carbon, right? Because if they did, you would be able to burn your backyard down when you had a bonfire. But you can't, because not all your soil has that much carbon. So not all permafrost has a lot of soil carbon, and thus it may not have the same processes to emit that much methane. However, we are seeing with the melting of permafrost an increase in methane, because over large landscapes, we are seeing more methane being released because the processes that cause methane release of decomposition and also just methane trapped in the soils when they were frozen is being released.
Can trees still grow in permafrost in frozen soil?
No, generally trees do not. And in fact, some interesting studies in Alaska and the Northwest Territories of Canada have shown that when permafrost does melt, that we see what are essentially an invasion of beaver dams, of beavers. And so beavers are a harbinger of climate change. When we see the beavers, that means that there's enough dwarf willow or dwarf shrubs. So this is a tree-like shrub, but not a tree.
So they're the true groundhogs for scientists, huh?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so instead of telling us how much winter we have left, right, It is telling us that, oh, this ground is now warm enough to support woody biomass, and there's enough woody biomass for beavers to build their homes, which means that's why we see more beaver dams and large ponds forming. I think a larger thing to think about is it is actually kind of a feedback loop, the way that you had posed the question. So when our permafrost melts, much of it is releasing more methane. Some of it will dry out, and because some of it has high carbon soils, it will be prone to wildfires, which emits more carbon dioxide and more methane, and thus drying out the landscape around it and melting even more permafrost, releasing more methane, and then opening up more soil that can dry out to potentially have a wildfire that will release more carbon dioxide, and so on and so forth in a positive feedback loop. And of course, that carbon dioxide and methane, methane is 24 to 25 times more potent of a climate forcer than carbon dioxide, will increase global temperatures.
Sorry to interrupt, but just to be clear, a positive feedback loop in this instance is not a good thing, right?
That's right. Yeah. Positive just means that it's self-reinforcing. Negative would mean that it would stop the feedback loop, right? This means the loop keeps going. It's not a positive thing. It's self-perpetuating. And in this case, it's not great, but we are entering, I would say, a new normal, as you put it, to describe the conditions of air quality and smoke along the coast in California. It's the same in the Arctic. So as the Arctic warms, more greenhouse gases are being emitted and more land is being made prone for wildfires. And what that does mean in the context of Greenland is that, you know, they really haven't had to be too concerned about tourists, about the Greenlandic indigenous peoples, about residents starting wildland fires with their campfires. But now they might need to do that. And so it's a changing a way of life. It's thinking about hunting and camping differently. It's thinking about doing tourism differently in the Arctic. And it's more importantly, it's thinking about their landscape as being a landscape that is fire prone and not just a landscape of ice.
I was under the impression that a lot of these more remote fires are started by lightning strikes. Is that not the case?
So sometimes they are. Most of our remote fires in the boreal zone will definitely be started by lightning. Some of them are started by human presence. So in Greenland, we know this year it was, I don't think the Greenlandic government or the Sisimiut fire chief has reported the exact cause, but it was started right beside the public camping houses of the Arctic Circle Trail. And the day before, many campfires were detected by several satellites. Sometimes they're caused by if the carbon-rich soil, the peat or humus, is dried out enough, it can spontaneously combust. That has been documented in Alaska and also in the Yukon and Northwest Territories of Canada. In Siberia, it has been documented that natural gas pipelines exploding have started large fires. So sometimes it's just these passive infrastructure elements on the landscape that an accident happens and it sparks a wildfire. But many of them are lightning. And it's actually a hard one to prove given our satellite observations, because the systems that monitor satellite strikes globally, they tend to stop at 50 degrees north. And so we don't have satellite observations of lightning strikes above that. And we're often reliant on ground reports or sometimes local radar systems for weather reporting.
And these are very remote areas with not a lot of people on the ground, I imagine.
Right, and probably not Doppler systems in place to do this type of monitoring.
Acadian driftwood, gypsy tailwind, they call my home the land of snow. Canadian cold front moving in, what a way.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Jessica McCarty. She's a professor at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. So Jessica, we were just discussing trying to capture data on how these Arctic wildfires start. You are part of a NOAA research team that analyzes fires in North America. Maybe you can kind of give us a peek behind the curtain into your team's methodology and what you do on a day-to-day basis to try to get us information.
Sure. And this is a NOAA-NASA field campaign. It's a dual campaign. And it's very large. And so I would just, quick shout out to the more than 50 institutions who are part of this large field campaign, including many federal agencies and our state level fire and forestry and natural resources agencies. So in the NOAA-NASA Fire XAQ campaign, our goal is really to conduct very state-of-the-art science tests of atmospheric chemistry of smoke plumes. And this means taking DC-8 planes and some twin otters and flying these planes equipped with specialized equipment to sample the many different pollutants, but also greenhouse gases that occur in the smoke from wildfires. Right now, NASA Fire XAQ, NOAA NASA Fire XAQ is based in Boise near the National Interagency Fire Center, or NIFC, and is dedicated to flying mainly wildland fires in the western U.S., but also parts of Alberta and British Columbia, Canada. It has a range that includes all the way into southern Mexico and just about and just past the Mississippi River from Boise and all the way up into northern British Columbia and Alberta. We are sampling forest fires, grassland fires, and we get a lot of this information from our satellite systems provided to us by NASA and NOAA, but also from our colleagues at the European Space Agency and from commercial data sources as well. We also, every morning, frantically, as a big team, search for any of the ground reports that have been released by our federal agencies, state-level agencies, and even our local news media. And so I think like everything during this interesting period we live in, local news sources are really, really important for studying wildland fire and smoke from fire and also climate impacts because they tell us a lot about the landscape, the people it's impacting, and exactly where the fire is occurring. Once we have those fire incidents, we do some forecasting. So we sit in a big room together. Some of us call in or WebEx in, and we figure out which fires we're going to be able to fly, you know, based on their amount of energy and smoke they're putting out. And then we try, as a big team, to build a flight path that will then be most efficient in sampling the most smoke plumes possible across the most diverse landscapes with different management practices, but also firefighting techniques. So we know if they have hotshot crews. We know if they are deploying helicopters. We know if they have mop-up teams on the ground. And so what this will make is the first ever data set that will let us know what is burning. So we'll have information from the ground. So what fuels, what vegetation burned, what, you know, human infrastructure or structures burned, and then what pollutants and greenhouse gases were emitted from that. And this will be the first of its kind scientific data set.
When you see a sensational headline, a sensationalist headline that says the Arctic's on fire, do you kind of roll your eyes or is this something that resonates with you?
I think that it resonates with me, but one of the good things about Twitter is that there's a lot of scientists globally who are on it and we get to engage with each other. And it has been a very good environment and community to try to present the historical context of some of these sensational headlines. You know, for instance, there were really large, gigantic wildland fires in northern Siberia in the 1970s and 80s, so large that the Soviet government actually asked for help from the Canadian Forest Service. And so I have colleagues who have recently retired in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, who spent years helping fight fires in Siberia. And in some of the same locations where we see fires now, because the fire return interval has shortened, and that's because of a warming climate. So some of these headlines maybe lack historical context. We have had large fires in the Arctic before. I think what is important, and this is sensational, and people should take this to heart, is that we're seeing fires in the Arctic in new places, and they're bigger, and they're lasting longer, and they're impacting the local populations in a way that we haven't seen before. And so that's a new Arctic, just like there's a new normal. We're looking at what the new Arctic looks like. Now, to think about this then in context of air quality, because wildfires and prescribed burning can often have a lot of negative impacts locally, but can be short-lived. You know, they might last an afternoon or a day, and sometimes a week, right, or a month. But the smoke, if the fires are hot enough, this smoke can actually be transported globally. So it can circulate around the world. And there's lots of fascinating studies that have shown that much of the black carbon deposition that we see on the Greenland ice sheet, so you can think of black carbon as the dark part of smoke. It's the soot that you see. It gets transported in our atmosphere above the tropopause from large fires in North America, and now we think even parts of far eastern Russia and Siberia, and deposits onto the Greenland ice sheet. And that dark black carbon, that soot, on a white background means that the ice sheet melts faster. And so in a large context, we have fires occurring halfway around the world that can impact the local warming and sometimes the local air quality of people who have no say over it, no input in how those fires are managed. And so wildfire and the smoke from wildfire is a good reminder that climate change is not going to be solved by a single person, and that, like it or not, we're all going to have to work together to make it better.
Jessica McCarty, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Yes, of course. Thank you for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Hugh Masekela, Mickey Hart, and The Roaches.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.